get this straight. If the indictment is... if the indictment is, and I have seen you say this, that crossfire reduces everything, as I said in the intro, to left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
Stop.
Why do we have to fight?
Why do you argue?
We're in bad shape, fellas.
We need help from the media, and they're hurting us.
You're doing theater when you should be doing debate.
You're listening to Under Surveillance, WLEW's biweekly show on popular culture, politics, and the relationship between mass media and public opinion. I'm your host, Kevin Fulham, and every second and fourth Wednesday mornings, I'll be joined by a series of guests as we take a look at everything from the makeup of the Supreme Court to upcoming elections and to how social and political climates impact our view of the future in film and television. Under Surveillance is broadcast on WLEW, a listener-supported community radio. And for more information or to listen to archive shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. The world of cinema has long been considered to be an intrinsically American art form, and youth culture is one of the nation's most profitable exports. How have various countries around the world reacted to the influx of American youth-oriented movies, from 50s rebellion films like The Wild One and Rebel Without a Cause, up through the modern day? And what sorts of notable themes do we find in foreign-made films about youth? We'll be discussing everything from City of God to Little Vera and Bend It Like Beckham, and my guest is Tim Sherry, Director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma, and co-editor of the recent book Youth Culture and Global Cinema. That's up next on Under Surveillance. My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLEW. And returning as my guest today is Timothy Sherry, Director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma, and editor of the book Youth Culture and Global Cinema, a collection of essays on the depiction of young people in films around the world. Welcome back to the show, Tim.
Thanks for inviting me back, Kevin.
Because of the history of Hollywood, the world of filmmaking is often considered to be intrinsically an American art form. And even today, American films are one of the country's biggest money-making exports. Do you feel that global politics and the unpopularity of the Bush regime have had an impact in terms of general reception to American youth culture overseas?
Oh, that's a great question, and I would say generally yes. You are so right that the American film industry dominates almost all global film industries. If you look in Variety every week at the international box office, probably for, I think they usually cover 8 to 10 countries, such as Japan, Hong Kong, Germany, France, and so on. Probably of those countries, at least over half to 75% have American films as their highest grossing, and the highest earning films that circulate in the international market are American films, without a doubt. As for the perception of youth and the current Bush administration, I just saw a news story yesterday about the extreme extent to which European nations or the people of European nations would rather see Barack Obama elected rather than John McCain. And their figures in the 80 to 90% range for Obama and under 20% for McCain. And I don't know if that has anything to do necessarily with McCain himself, but I know Bush is incredibly unpopular overseas. And it could well be that the reception of teen films abroad, which has not traditionally been very good, is affected by the negative perceptions of President Bush and the Bush administration. You know, I also say that I think a lot of the teen films that come out in the U.S. of a more frivolous nature, you know, your sex comedies and your horror films, also don't translate to a lot of other cultures that well. I think a lot of other cultures are either past the giggly titillation of the average American teen sex comedy, or they simply don't find much appeal in how teenagers are traumatized and victimized in a lot of teen horror films and crime movies, for instance.
Youth Culture and Global Cinema opens with a discussion of European reaction to the 1950s American quote-unquote rebellion movies, such as Marlon Brando's The Wild One and James Dean's Rebel Without a Cause, and how these films were heavily edited by government censors. Why were European countries so fearful of these sorts of films?
That's one of the interesting historical ironies, is that in the 50s there was this perception in the United States that teenagers were going out of control. They weren't even quite the children of the baby boom, of course, because if they were teenagers between 55 and and 60, they obviously had to be born in the late 30s or early 40s, but the baby boom was known, and it was known that more children were, or more people were going to be teenagers in the U.S. in the 60s, and I think there was this anticipation of some kind of terror in the youth population. And you could argue in some cases that that was borne out, because by the late 60s, you certainly had uprisings at college campuses across the country, and you had the emergence of rock and roll back in the 50s that gave teenagers a musical platform for rebellion. And you had teenagers not wearing the same clothes anymore. They started wearing boots and dungarees, as they were called at the time, leather jackets. And abroad, I think there was a far greater fear of the wave of youth violence spreading and protest than there was anything having to do with sexuality. Most European countries had already been further along in terms of sex education and in terms of trying to keep their children informed and safe in terms of their sexual practices if they engaged in them. But that was very taboo in the U.S. You had very few movies in the U.S. dealing with sex, like Splendor in the Grass. Splendor in the Grass dealt with two teenagers who, in 1961, two teenagers back in the Depression era, I think it's the late 20s, early 30s, they want to consummate their relationship so badly, one of them, Natalie Wood, loses her mind. I mean, she ends up in an asylum because of her sexual torment. And Bud, the Warren Beatty character, he doesn't end up in asylum. He just gets sick and can't play basketball as well. But that wasn't the concern for most of the censors abroad. The concern, for instance, in Rebel Without a Cause were things like the knife fight, the Chickie Run, where they drive their cars to the edge of the cliff, and of course Buzz accidentally goes off the edge of the cliff. In The Wild One, it was the scenes with the motorcycle gangs infiltrating the town and seeming to take over and terrorize the small town and its people. And it's quite a contrast, again, to a lot of the American concerns about youth in terms of things like sex and drugs, whereas Hollywood was more comfortable dealing with violence among youth, and has been ever since, by the way. You know, they really quit making teen movies about youth sexual practice in the mid-80s, when the teenage pregnancy rate was really going up and AIDS was such a big fear, and they really didn't address it all at all for about 15 years thereafter. But teen violence was on a great roll in terms of profitability, especially in the 90s. And that's just, I think, an American idiosyncrasy, is that the culture is far more willing to see violence and far more willing to be entertained by violence than they are with sexual issues. And the Europeans certainly don't seem to respond the same way. And that's what led to so much of that censorship, because it was almost entirely about the violence and very little about the sexual tensions. Especially in a film like Rebel Without a Cause, it's very clear that the Plato character, played by Sal Mineo, is in love with Jim, James Dean. And that issue was much more toned down in the Warner Brothers development by the studio. They didn't want it to be all that evident that there was this you know, same-sex crush, and it still comes out, I think, pretty clearly, but that wasn't nearly as big a concern in the European censors.
Yeah, and you mentioned certainly the 90s, the American movies featuring inner-city gangs and violence. You have Boys in the Hood, you have Menace in Society. Did you see the same sort of censorship and hostile reaction to those sorts of films as well in European culture?
Well, I don't think that they translate as well, in the sense that, with few exceptions, I think a lot of the movies that have been made in the U.S. about gang wars and you know, urban violence just don't connect with foreign audiences that much. One exception, or one area of exception, that I certainly know of is the Parisian suburbs have often been rocked by youth gangs and youth violence, and there was a great film made in the mid-90s called La Haine, or Hate, and that dealt with teen gangs and racial and interracial violence. And that was just as the peak of American movies about urban violence, you know, was fading. I think that for the most part, you just don't have the criminal records and the penal systems in other countries, most other countries at least, that you do in the U.S., dealing with juveniles and dealing with juvenile problems. And that, again, is what gives the American culture something of a bad image. is that it seems like we have so much, and yet our youth are, you know, ending up in drug treatment programs. They're still getting pregnant in their teenage years before they get married. They're ending up in jails, and our tabloids seem to celebrate this. It seems that everyone loves a train wreck, and especially if it's a child star that was once big and is now fallen, that's even better.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. And joining me today is Tim Sherry, director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma. He's also the editor of the book, Youth Culture and Global Cinema. It's a collection of essays on the depiction of young people in film around the world. And so, you know, we talked a little bit about the violence of the American teen films in the early 90s with films like Boys in the Hood. There's another film that came out in 2002 called City of God.
Yeah.
And it's a foreign film set in the slums of Rio de Janeiro.
Mm-hmm.
And it follows a group of children as they deal with the dangerous streets. And many of them grow into violent gangsters.
Well, first of all, it's an extremely well-made film, very stylish in its cinematography and editing. Fernando Marella just hit all the right cylinders in terms of getting the production made, casting it. He used a lot of true neighborhood kids, some of whom themselves were gang members.
Yeah, I think only one was a real professional actor.
Right, and he just pulled together a production that was very creative and dynamic, and it also wasn't just about teenagers being bad. It was about the influence on them from adult figures, drug lords. It was also about their neighborhoods and how they're designed, how crime is essentially taught from a young age. It's not something that children necessarily want to do, but it's something that they find either pleasure in or at least financial means of survival through. It's one of the great, great films about youth in recent years. The reception of it, I think, was somewhat mixed, although I know the Academy nominated him for an Oscar for Best Director, and its violence is certainly off-putting. I mean, there's one extremely disturbing scene involving child-on-child violence, but it's not the kind of film that revels in violence and celebrates it, which I think was the fault of some of the urban youth films in the early 90s. I think Boys in the Hood, for instance, is a fine film overall until the climactic ending, when the Ice Cube character guns down the guys who gunned down his brother. And I saw it in the theater, and when he does that, everyone applauded. And everyone was elated that, you know, vengeance had been achieved, and brutally and unjustly. And, well, okay, granted, they had killed his brother. Now he's killed them, and you'll find out in the closing credits he got killed not long after that, as if that was supposed to make the circle of justice complete somehow. The funny thing with City of God in terms of the ending, in the end, the main gangster, the teenager who's risen up to become sort of the mafia don of the local community, is murdered by children. It turns out that, you know, the cycle is going to continue because they live in such poverty and they live in such deplorable conditions. The police are corrupt, the drug lords, of course, themselves are corrupt, and then the children learn to follow that cycle. And the film shows in a very graphic and, again, I will say stylish way, how this continues, and it is not didactic. It doesn't offer any solutions to it. But the woman who wrote the essay for our anthology, Sonia Lino, you know, made clear that the use of the chicken in the film, for instance, is loaded with symbolism because it's as if these children have become some form of livestock. You know, they're just being produced to rise up, engage in the criminal lifestyle, die too young, but before they do, have more children themselves. That's a nightmare vision that a lot of Americans, I think, fear, and I think is sometimes exploited in some of our movies and in recent political campaigning at the same time.
Yeah, and with City of God, you have, you know, you mentioned the group of kids at the end who wind up murdering the drug lord. I mean, the kids, the kind of the gangbangers, I mean, they get younger and younger in this film. And at the end, you have a group of kids. They're probably none older than, say, 10 or 11.
Right.
They're all brandishing guns openly, marching down the street. It's a far, far cry from what was looked at as being horrifying in Rebel Without a Cause. You know, there you have a knife fight. You know? You've got, you know, dozens of kids who are armed.
Even then in Rebel Without a Cause, the James Dean character says, I thought knives were just for punks. You know, he doesn't want to fight with knives. And the Buzz character says, well, we're not actually going to fight with knives. We're just going to, like, poke each other. You know, it's not meant to be stabbing. Yeah, by the time you get to, well, the 90s American urban crime movies and then something like City of God, you've got outright warfare with children. It does remind me of a film, a very notorious film from 1968, which was one of the most, the term I often toss out, although it's a fancy schmancy psychological term, is ephebophobic or ephebophobia, which is the fear of teenagers. This film called Wild in the Streets came out in 1968, and it was about a teenager who in his early 20s had risen up to become one of the wealthiest men in the world and had done so primarily through drug dealing and through shady business practices. Well, he gets in line with a senator in California and gets the voting age lowered to 15. And in the beginning of the film, they're all angry and talking about how the majority of Americans are under the age of 25, or at least they were at that time. Well, they eventually, as you could probably guess, take over the country. And this young entrepreneur of sorts, but he's also a shyster and he's a pop star. He has to sing in a rock band. Well, anyway, he becomes the leader of the country, and eventually he faces his downfall. But the very final scene of the film, which is what reminds me of City of God, he's out at a little lake, and some kids come along, and he tells them off. He dismisses them and says, you kids, leave me alone. Get out of my way. One of these kids, who's probably about 10, looks right at the camera and says, in another few years, we're going to put everyone over 12 out of business. And it gives you this, again, this ephebophobic sense that the children will rise up, and they're not going to inherit the earth. They're going to terrorize it and take it over. And that's a kind of mythology that goes back at least into the early to mid-20th century, because I think so many people fear their children becoming too powerful and becoming too computer savvy, able with technology. Guns have been around much longer than computers and cell phones and so on. And you've got so many people concerned about how teenagers not only get internet access, but how they use their cell phones and text messages and so on.
Oh, yeah. And teenagers could communicate to each other. I mean, I remember reading an article about kids sitting in the back seat of a parent's car, and they've got cell phones, and they're texting. And, the parents like, well, don't you think that's very rude to text in front of your friends? And one of the girls is saying, well, no, we're texting each other. We just don't want you to know what we're saying.
I understand that impulse and appreciate that. I think in many ways that's a teenager's dream come true, is that you can communicate with other teenagers in a closed circuit. Adults don't have access to it, or if they have access to it, they don't have access to your specific communications. And teenagers can tell each other their stories and ideas and fears and fantasies. Yet the dilemma with that, of course, as every parent fears, and I'm a parent now and certainly getting worried, is that you lose touch with your children. And that's bad enough that you don't know as much as about what's going on with them, but it could well be that they are in dangerous communications. And it's not just internet predators you need to worry about, but it could be that they're texting drug deals, or they're texting information about their health that they're not telling you, and it could be a very simple, understandable health problem. But they might ask a friend, how do I deal with a cold sore? Or what do I do about this strange rash on my back, or whatever? It could be something as simple as that I think a generation ago teenagers would have asked their parents about. But now with the internet and with, it seems, almost unlimited access to communication with other teenagers, they're becoming more insular and they're becoming more disconnected from their parents. And that, I think that is a legitimate concern.
And that's also something that you touch on in youth culture and global cinema. One of the chapters deals with, it's called Rebels with a Cause, mm-hmm. Children versus the Military-Industrial Complex. And you've got, an American movie like War Games, for instance, with Matthew Broderick, where his parents clearly have no idea of what he's doing. And meanwhile, he's using modems and plugging into NORAD and almost starting World War III.
And that chapter is written by Mick Broderick, who's an Australian film scholar and professor, and he studies nuclear era history, and I think he articulates quite well what was going on there from after the war into the 80s and 90s, is this fear that youth would not only gain access to technology through technologies of communication and knowledge, but technologies of power and violence. And he looks at a 50s movie, I'm going to forget the title all of a sudden, I think it's Oh, the Space Children. In the Space Children, a group of children come into contact with an alien force that convinces them to convince the adults in their lives and then eventually the military that we should not be building nuclear weapons. Well, isn't that a quaint idea? That was almost entirely remade, repackaged in the late 80s as a film called Amazing Grace and Chuck, in which a little leaguer decides he's not going to pitch baseball anymore until there's no more threat of nuclear war. And of course, you think this is just some stunt. It's some little, you know, American dream. But over time, he gets professional sports players to agree to the same oath. And then sports aren't being played anymore, and the children take a vow of silence, and the whole world is collapsing because of this one little kid who decided he wasn't going to pitch Little League anymore and wants the end of nuclear weapons. It's a great fantasy. It would never happen in real life, of course. But Mick Broderick in that chapter, I think, just examines so effectively the ways in which, on the one hand, many adults fear children's access to technologies of communication and power. On the other hand, we, of course, look to them to guide us, you know, on a certain moral compass, because after all, how many times do you hear politicians say, well, our children and grandchildren are, for instance, going to inherit this debt. You know, our children and grandchildren are the ones who are going to have to deal with our wasteful spending or our proliferation of nuclear weapons or so on. And there is an obvious paradox there, because we fear the children having power, and yet we also want them to tell us what innocence is and remind us that they're the ones we're living for. And to go back to Mick Broderick's essay and an examination of nuclear era issues, I grew up in an era where the threat of complete nuclear annihilation was there. We talked about it. We didn't go back as far, or my generation at least didn't go back as far as those that did the duck and cover drills and worry about the nuclear blast, but we were certainly still worried about a global war with the Soviet Union. And by the 90s, that threat, if it wasn't completely over, it was pretty much marginalized. And my students today, who are all born in the early 90s, seem to think that there isn't a real global war threat. The threat that they concern themselves with is something along the lines of course, 9/11, that there could be rogue groups or small cells that might rise up and hit individual places. And I can also tell you that's extremely sensitive where I am now in Oklahoma.
Oklahoma, sure.
The Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, and that was by a domestic terrorist. That was by, you know, someone who essentially was a local. That seems to be a much bigger concern, you know, local problems than global threats. At the same time, I think, I can only imagine, I haven't got any good statistics on it, but I can only imagine a lot of students, especially in high school and colleges today, are probably dismayed or at least frustrated by how long the current war has gone on and that it still has no end in sight. You know, this started in late 2001, after the U.S. was attacked, and it's moved from one country to another, and it just keeps on going. And I think that will certainly weigh quite heavily on the next generation's perception of the military and war and government.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. And returning as my guest is Tim Cherry, director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma. He's also the editor of the book Youth Culture and Global Cinema, a collection of essays on the depiction of young people in films around the world. And Tim, in one chapter of the book, it's discussed how the press responds more positively to quote-unquote feminist messages when the lead characters are of non-Western descent. Mm. And so you take a look at films such as Whale Rider and Bandit Like Beckham. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about these films and why this might be the case?
Yes, the chapter you're referring to is by a great feminist film author named Sarah Perjansky, and part of her argument revolves around the tension that a lot of Americans and specifically white Americans feel regarding girls becoming more feminist in their beliefs and demanding more equal treatment with men, compared to this perception that girls and teenage young women from other countries are oppressed racially or ethnically, as well as in terms of their gender, and therefore that's a more legitimate cause, that somehow they need to not only deal with their gender oppression, but in the case of Whale Rider, for instance, it's also age oppression, and on another level, it's ethnic oppression, but really not nearly as much. It's much more about her gender oppression, and Whale Rider was a big hit here. Keisha Castle Hughes was nominated for an Oscar for that film, for Best Actress. I think she's the youngest woman ever nominated for Best Actress in the Oscars. And Perjansky's point is well taken, because it does seem that we have far more movies like Mean Girls, where there's kind of lip service paid to feminism. There's this, you know, suggestion that girls don't help themselves when they're against each other, that competition is ultimately kind of self-destructive. But they don't obviously offer any real solutions to that other than to say, well, let's quit bickering and let's try to get along better. And of course, you know, here a few years later, since not only Whale Rider but also Mean Girls, one of the most popular shows among teenage girls is Gossip Girl. And we have an increasing number of gossip pages erupting on the internet and encouraging misbehavior and you know, duplicity and deception among young people, especially young women. So I think it's quite interesting that Perjansky examines that so well, and she does it especially well through looking at the press responses, the critical responses to those films. In Whale Rider, the main character is a Maori girl from New Zealand. In Bend It Like Beckham, the main character, Jess Minder, is Indian but living in Britain. It focuses, it seems, more on her conflicted relationship with her mother and father and her desire to become a star soccer player than it does, you know, on her gender oppression. And that is quite interesting, that kind of lets the film off the hook in terms of not dealing with the question of whether or not these girls can truly become self-supporting sports stars and, you know, powerful and successful. It's kind of, it's a displacement of sorts.
Do you see more assimilation in terms of minority cultures in the larger society in films depicting, you know, Europe or South America? Or, I mean, it seems even in America here with American youth films, you still have audiences very segregated.
Yeah.
In terms of here, okay, you've got your films with white characters, black characters, and they have very different experiences. They don't really mix very often. How about, say, you know, in terms of, you know, young Indians and British, or in terms of, you know, France, the Muslim population, the Moroccans, the Arab population?
Well, that's a great question, and I honestly haven't seen enough films to make a truly informed statement on that. I will say that you can sometimes sense the tension in American films with youth when there's only the one black teenager amongst a group of friends who, as Not Another Teen Movie joked years ago, is the token black, you know, and that's a phrase that has obviously been circulated quite a lot. And yet at the same time, you don't have the token Christian or the token Jewish student, you know. They don't seem to diversify in terms of religion. Maybe they do actually a little bit in terms of disability. I will say that. I've seen that more often lately, the disabled student in Malcolm in the Middle, and it seems like there's been a few disabled students in other teen film depictions lately that are just happen to be disabled, and it's not really addressed. To use another example from a movie about religion, Saved, Macaulay Culkin plays a disabled high school student in a wheelchair, and his disability is very little part of his character. His character is much more a foil to criticize his sister. And he pulls it off very well. I question the sincerity of those kinds of depictions, be it, you know, in terms of race or disability or ethnicity, religion, because sometimes it does seem to be a casting trick. Sometimes it just seems to be an effort to give perhaps an actor a little bit of a challenge. And I know, as you probably know, Robert Downey Jr. was criticized for this most recently in Tropic Thunder. You know, a white actor, supposed to be Australian, I think it's supposed to be a Russell Crowe reference, making himself into an African-American character for the making of the film within the film.
Yeah, it's reminiscent of C. Thomas Howell in Soul Man, right, in the 80s.
Which was very controversial and at the time, you know, very sensitive, because the question was all around affirmative action. Yeah, this young man, C. Thomas Howell, having his skin treated to make him trying to pass as a black student to get into law school. And it didn't go very far, and it wasn't a very good movie, but it did raise some interesting questions about how our culture at the time was responding to what was perceived advantage to being black or to having affirmative action. And I think that was very symptomatic of the Reagan administration at that time.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. And joining me today is Tim Sherry, director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma. He's also the editor of the book Youth Culture and Global Cinema, a collection of essays on the depiction of young people in films around the world. And we're talking a little bit about films depicting a quote-unquote feminist message, such as Bend It Like Beckham, Whale Rider. Regarding young women in general, it's interesting that there seems to be a lot more concern over, say, you know, dress codes in Europe, for instance, you know, girls wearing veils in school in France or England. You hear more about those sorts of issues, or you know, you hear, you know, Muslim immigration in the Netherlands. There's this big, you know, clash of cultures. Mm-hmm. But you don't hear too much, or at least comparatively as much, about rampant prostitution problems involving teenage females in Eastern Europe. And there's a chapter of the book called The Age of Transition, Angels and Blockers in Recent Eastern and Central European Films, written by Aniko Imre.
Well, she and other writers examine these films about young people, especially teenage girls, who either fall into prostitution or drug use or both, and their opportunities to get out or get around those destinies. And you're absolutely right. Our culture, America, is certainly quite uncomfortable dealing with youthful sexuality, but I think the entire world is uncomfortable dealing with youthful sexual exploitation, whether it's prostitution, abuse, incest. The fact is, it unfortunately happens. It should never happen. It happens far more often than it's ever reported. And while people like Nancy Grace on Headline News are criticized for sensationalizing some of these situations, I applaud that approach insofar as it does make people aware that children are abducted every day, children are unfortunately abused every day, and there's a lot of cases out there that haven't been solved. There's a lot of adults that have not been brought to justice and should be. At the same time, I also know sensationalizing those cases does sell. It does get people watching and talking. In the East European films that, for the most part, the mainstream youth films like I Love Budapest, you know, set in Hungary, that deal with the counterculture of youth, you know, the drugs and the sex and so on. And unlike many American films, didn't sensationalize it. It was, I Love Budapest is a stylish film, but it's also a very confrontational film about what these characters go through. And it has this incredibly unusual and relatively controversial ending where, while the boy and the girl are fleeing from the police, and it seems they're about to be killed or arrested, their car flies off into the sky, and it's a completely fanciful, delusional ending that I don't think a lot of audiences perhaps appreciated, because it seems that the director wanted to make this commentary on the fact that their lives really are this bad, and it's only delusion that's going to get them out of it. There's other great films like Lilia Forever and Christian F., which is actually back in the early 80s, about German a German girl and German youth population falling into the drug culture. And those films get some attention in the United States, but because they're not uplifting and funny, they tend to only appeal and only gain recognition in their home country or countries closer to them. And I think that it would be quite educational for our young people in the United States to see a lot of films dealing with young populations and in at least Eastern Europe and Asia, if not also other parts of the world. You know, Africa has extremely few teen films that you could even cite. In fact, I say in the preface to the book that when, and I should also point out, excuse me, that Alexandra Siebel is my co-editor on this book. When she and I were pulling together our ideas and thinking about what essays we could have or what focuses we should be looking for, we were very conscious of the fact that it was essentially impossible to find anyone who had worked on African youth in terms of the actual representation of teenagers in African nations. The closest we came was an essay that at least involved Egyptian youth and their Muslim identity. And Egypt's obviously a part of Africa, but we really couldn't find anyone who could do work on youth in Saharan or sub-Saharan Africa, and we couldn't find a single piece of research in that area either.
Just going backtracking just a little bit,
because
sure. You talked about, you know, I heard Budapest.
I heard Budapest
about the fantasy sequence at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. A couple of other films depicting women in various cultures, also kind of resorting to fantasy to deal with uncomfortable situations in life. One of them was Heavenly Creatures, directed by Peter Jackson, came out in the 90s.
Kate Winslet and Melanie Lynskey, sure.
Yeah, and I think they're British girls.
Are they British or Australian?
But perhaps they're Australian, and one of them kills their mother, I believe.
They both kill one of their mothers.
Okay, because they're both in love with each other, right? It takes place.
They're essentially in love with each other, and they kill one of their mothers because they find her so oppressive, and they develop this complicated fantasy life, which Peter Jackson was so adept at representing through puppetry and special effects and makeup and so on. And in the fantasy world, they're happy and they have these wonderful experiences. But meanwhile, in the reality of things, they're both pretty miserable and unhappy, and it drives them to murder. Yeah.
The other one I was thinking of is Pan's Labyrinth.
Oh, sure. I need to confess up front that I haven't seen it, but it seems to me from what I've read that there's another construction of she's maybe 10.
She's maybe 10, yeah. It's made by Guillermo del Toro. He's a Mexican filmmaker, and set in Spain right around the time of Spanish Civil War, around the 1940s.
And it seems that that's an interesting approach to take on childhood perception of war and strife and construction of fantasy to cope. Think of another German film dealing with war issues, The Tin Drum, in the 1980s, which also took on war and childhood from a child's perspective. Again, we come back to this issue, as I said before, that it seems adults are always fearful of youth and fearful for youth, that they want them to be upstanding, good citizens and behave, and at the same time, they know that their activities as adults influence their children into doing things like misbehaving and setting up wars and fighting with each other and developing bad habits. I think that the relationship in movies between children and adults is just ripe with drama and irony in that way.
And we talked a little bit about the teenage prostitution in terms of Eastern European society and films depicting those sorts of situations. How about notable films about strong young female characters growing up in the old Soviet Union or Eastern Bloc countries, or even now in terms of modern Russia? Is there anything? Is there any kind of equivalent to an Amelie, for instance?
It would be nice if there were more, and there's really not many. In Russia, around 1987, there was a film called Little Vera, which is discussed in our book, and the young woman is, I think, maybe 20, and the moral of the story is that she can tolerate and rise above the suburban Moscow existence that she has. She can be somewhat liberated and somewhat confident. In the late 80s, that was very appealing to, I think, American sensibilities, in the sense that we were hoping the Russian Empire was fading and that the Soviet Union was going to break apart, as it did. But overall, it's really not a very good movie. If you want movies that depict young women becoming confident, at least confident, if not powerful, I'd like to recommend another one that's in the book and covered very well in two different chapters called Show Me Love from Sweden. The original title is one that I can't say on the radio. It involves an infamous slang word, but they re-released it as Show Me Love. And it's a very sweet story about two girls in a Swedish school system, one of whom's kind of small and tomboyish and doesn't think she's very attractive, and the other one is blonde, beautiful, buxom, and quite popular. And, wouldn't you know, the tomboy, of course, is in love with the princess, And the princess decides that she's going to use the tomboy girl as a target of ridicule. And after she does, she begins to feel bad about it. And then she begins to say to herself, maybe I've at least been mean. And then she begins to consider if maybe she actually has an attraction to this girl. And ultimately, the two of them fall in love. But it's not easy. They, you know, they go through arguments and negotiations about how they're going to do this. And finally, in the end, they decide that they're going to effectively come out to their entire school, and they'll be okay with it. And they do. There's a really funny sequence in which they're stuck in a bathroom together, which I think is otherwise supposed to be a closet, you know, and of course they come out of the closet and they tell everyone, you know, look, we're together, leave us alone. And the final scene is not them consummating the relationship or doing anything salacious. The final scene is them sharing chocolate milk and talking about how they like the taste of chocolate milk and wondering, you know, where the relationship is going to go. Now, that doesn't sound like a very empowering story. It doesn't sound like a story about women perhaps, you know, taking over in a formal political way. But it's a very heartening story about how, you know, young girls, especially in the case of the popular girl, a young girl with power herself because she's pretty and popular, can reconsider her role and can, you know, change her life to live as she might like, because she's otherwise very much deluded by the friends and the family around her that keep telling her how great she is, and she really isn't feeling that. And the tomboy, of course, is deluded in a similar way into feeling bad, and she is actually much better off than she realizes. So I would recommend a film like Show Me Love as a example of, that's I think 2002 from Sweden, a more contemporary film that shows that young women can negotiate a certain sense of political presence. In this case, it is through their sexual identity, so it's not as dramatic or as grand as it might be, you know, if we had a film about, say, a teenage girl who ran for political office or a teenage girl who became the CEO of a major corporation or something like that. Those films might be around the corner, though.
My name is Kevin Fulham, and you're listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. And my guest is Tim Sherry, director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma, and co-editor of the book Youth Culture and Global Cinema, a collection of essays on the depiction of young people in films around the world. What do you see in the future as far as emerging themes in youth-oriented global films? Whether that's an emphasis on different parts of the world or you know, different social topics, for instance?
I would not be at all surprised, as I think you were suggesting earlier, that we do see a few more films on Muslim youth. There have been really very few depictions of Muslim youth in U.S. movies. I can think of Pretty Persuasion, and Persepolis is, I think, something of a U.S. co-production.
Just a note here. Yeah, we were talking about this before the show in terms of you know, Muslims and Persepolis, which is it just came out you know, this past year as an animated film, but based on comic books that Marjane Satrapi has written about her experiences growing up in Iran during the time of the Islamic Revolution.
Right, and I don't know how the industry would technically label that in terms of its national background, and, you know, if it's an Iranian film, an American film, co-production, and so on. Those are kind of just academic terms. But we certainly have seen very few Islamic youth in American movies. We've definitely also seen few Jewish youth in American movies, and not even that many Christian youth in American movies. But I wouldn't be surprised, especially if Barack Obama is elected, that the industry begins to at least offer some examinations of religious and cultural experiences that are beyond the average white experience. And I think that would be refreshing, especially if those films were dramas and comedies and not about war and terrorism and meant to be for thrills.
One common criticism of American people in general, especially with regards to youth, is that it's a very insular society with regards to culture. We're not really very well informed about other countries, other societies. Film is just a great window to look at how other people live and behave.
certainly, overall, we have young people today more connected to people around the world than ever before, primarily thanks to the Internet. Whether they're actually communicating with them directly or just seeing, say, their videos on YouTube or reading some of their blogs, there's no doubt we have more communication today among people in general, and especially young people, thanks to the Internet. And I think that's wonderful, because I think that universalizes us all more. I ascribe to the belief that we all are humans. We all have the same interests in being happy and achieving peace. Unfortunately, there's still great conflicts around how that's done and how it's done most effectively. But this is what I was getting at with films about youth. I do hope and truly anticipate that we will at least see more films addressing the issue of international contact, appreciation of different cultures and races, less xenophobia, less fear of the other, less tension around religious differences. Despite 9/11, despite what my generation went through with the Soviet Union and so on, for instance, I think we are seeing progress being made toward more universal understanding and appreciation. And to go back to early on in this dialogue, it's really a lot about the fact that adults, while they run the show, really need their children to remind them of what's innocent and what's right and what they're working the entire system to achieve.
You've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW, and I've been joined today by Tim Sherry, director of the Film and Video Studies Department at the University of Oklahoma, and he's also the co-editor of the book Youth Culture and Global Cinema, a collection of essays on the depiction of young people in films around the world. And thanks once again for coming back on the show, Tim. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kevin. It's been a great pleasure.
For Tim Sherry, my name is Kevin Fulham, and you've been listening to Under Surveillance on WLUW. For more information or to listen to archived shows, visit www.undersurveillance.org. That's www.undersurveillance.org.